Well, I presented to Laura a challenge this week that I understood was going to be a challenge, and she did find one piece of religious music that referred to the government, and that was the Hallelujah Chorus, and we decided not to sing that one. But you know, Laura works very hard to try to have the hymns of the day reinforce the message of the day as she reads over it. I give her an outline, or a very brief little outline of what the message is going to be, and hopefully next week will be a little easier. What do you say about in hymns about separation of church and state? I don't know what you say about it. I'm going to try to say something in the message, because I believe that this is an important message for us. And so our reading today is from Romans, the 13th chapter. Interesting instruction for Christians on the part of Paul, who was in Rome at the time. He said, "Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and you will be commended. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also as a matter of conscience. This is also why you pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants, who give their full time to governing. Give to everyone what you owe them. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor." We ask that, Lord, to bless our reading of His Word and our hearing of it. Someone very wise has said, "Anything is open to discussion except religion and politics." Others came along and added the topics of money and sex to the forbidden to discuss in public topics. I guess you might call that no speaking of religion and politics as somewhat of a famous quotation. And when you want to find famous quotations, there are a few individuals who have provided us with the great quotations. Shakespeare, Benjamin Franklin, Mark Twain, Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Jesus, of course, to name a few of the most prolific and interesting quote makers. One that you may not know is G.K. Chesterton. Is that a familiar name to you? Probably not. Probably not. He's an English gentleman of the early 1900s, the early 20th century. Some say, and I think there's reason perhaps to say this, he was the most prolific writer of the 20th century. He wrote over 100 books and thousands of published essays, and much of his writing is both witty and pithy. Regarding the open discussion of religion, Chesterton wrote, "Religious liberty might be supposed to mean that everybody is free to discuss religion. In practice, it means that hardly anybody is allowed to mention it." Smart guy. We can probably thank Thomas Jefferson for this following one, but it actually was a combination of the efforts by several of our founding fathers. Jefferson was one of the combination of leaders in writing the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which says, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." The courts referred to the two clauses in that First Amendment as the Establishment Clause. Actually, it could be more accurately have the title of No Establishment Clause, and the Free Exercise Clause. So remember those two specific titles of those two vital clauses. Establishment Clause, no prohibiting of the free exercise, the establishment of religion, and Free Exercise Clause, no prohibiting of the free exercise thereof. See what I just did? I just violated that general rule of prohibiting discussions, talking openly here today about religion and politics. Well, shame on me. No, I don't think so. See, we're here at church, and I pretty much think you expect me to talk religion any Sunday that I get up to preach. And what is the topic that has recently completely dominated the broadcast news, radio and television, the conversation in our homes and places of business, our print media, newspapers, weekly magazines, and certainly the complete evening time of the television networks? What's dominated that? The one topic of the day for the past week and for next week? Well, it's politics, of course. The Republican convention this past week and Donald Trump. The Democrat convention of this week ahead of us and Hillary Clinton. Like it or not, we can't very well escape it right now, can we? It's just out there. So I'm going to preach. I'm going to deliver a religious sermon this morning on a political issue, one that cannot be ignored by the church, can't be ignored by our attention. And I'm going to preach a political issue in religious terms. You see, our good country, the United States of America, was the first nation ever to establish the constitutional principle of religious liberty and no establishment of particular specific religious principles. And in America, when you encounter this idea, it is usually presented under the slogan separation of church and state. Notice, please, that I said slogan, not law. This slogan was inspired by Thomas Jefferson's comment, mind you, that the First Amendment erected a wall of separation between church and state. That's where that comes from. But there's no legal statement, no specific statement in the U.S. Constitution that establishes the rigid concept of separation of church and state. No statement that states that you cannot mention anything religious in politics and that you cannot mention politics in a religious setting. It's just not there. The history of this concept is long and detailed. And here in America goes all the way back to a start at it back in 1663, when the effort to free ourselves from the monarchy of England as religious mandate got its beginning. But the whole story is too long and too tedious for this sermon. So I'll give you just a quick synopsis of the history and then get us to the basic important concept of why and how our Republic of the States that United as the Nation of America has and must have real freedom of religion in a free nation. This principle of separation of church and state developed as a remedy to church control over the state and to state control over the church. The religious clauses of the First Amendment of our Constitution are a corrective of any and all former arrangements between church and state, stretching way back over several centuries. When the Roman Emperor Constantine, back in the early 300s, adopted Christianity as the official religion of the empire, government officially began to intervene by law in religious matters. For all intents and purposes, and by law, the church was under the governance of the state. After the church gained more and more power and influence through the Middle Ages, and in 962, the Holy Roman Empire was founded, and the Bishop of Rome, the person who a few years later became known as the Pope, as the head of the official church, was now leading in governance. In about 1070, there was a head-on conflict between the Pope, it was Gregory the Seventh, and the Roman Emperor, who was Heinrich the Fourth, each of whom claimed the highest power. In this key time in the Middle Ages, the doctrine of papal primacy emerged, meticulously detailed by Pope Gregory the Seventh. Gregory contended that he was God's vicar with absolute authority in both spiritual, that is the church, and temporal, that is civil, matters. He asserted that the Pope can control the church hierarchy, that he can approve and depose emperors, that he cannot err, and that all persons, clerical and lay, owe obedience to the Pope because he represents God. The view of Gregory the Seventh was now that the church is over the state. But the emperor of the Roman Empire, Germanic King Heinrich, would not concede to that authority, and a vast civil war broke out. For generations, the conflict between church and state persisted. Finally, in 1122, the Pope and the emperor at that time agreed that the emperor would defer to the Pope in spiritual matters, and that the Pope would defer to the emperor in civil matters. And this compromise pleased neither the Pope nor the emperor. And the Pope plowed on ahead. It wasn't long before the church's official teaching became that because spiritual matters are superior to temporal matters, the church is superior to the state. Well, that existed for a long time. Skipping lightly now through history, a history lesson. We're now to 1534, and the next chapter was that the English king, Henry VIII, established the English Reformation. It was a law desired by and adopted by Parliament that the king is the supreme head of the church. That law implied that civil authority, that is the king, is dominant in religious matters. And the Church of England, Anglicanism, was established as the official religion. Well, not of the whole world, but the official religion of England. Well, this is just a short list, but listen to the complete dominance of the English King's Church of England, of the Anglicans. Between 1661 and 1673, Parliament passed laws given to them by the king to limit high civil office to Anglicans, to require complete conformity to the Anglican system, and to remove all ministers who objected to any part of it, to forbid meetings for religious purposes other than in Anglican settings, to increase penalties for illegal religious meetings within given miles of a parish church house, and to make conformity to the Anglican system the condition for selection to civil offices and government service. And I just hit on a few of the restrictive laws. Thus, the state, the monarchy, used its powers to establish one religious group and to penalize all others. And this is the majority of the reasons the Pilgrims, the Puritans, and other nonconformists left England to come for a new start, possibly more religious freedom in the new country of America. Then in 1663, the Rhode Island colony, due to the labors of Roger Williams, a good Baptist, and John Clark, obtained a charter from King Charles II of England, guaranteeing religious liberty for Rhode Island. But Rhode Island was just a small colony. It wasn't the nation. It is believed that Charles II may have granted a charter for Rhode Island's what he called lively experiment, fully expecting the experiment to fail, thus proving that a stable society requires a union of church and state and a uniformity of religion. But Rhode Island's policy succeeded, and its underlying principles became increasingly popular through other colonies. As the American colonists struggled for political and civil freedom during the American Revolution, some, especially those affiliated with minority religious groups, contended for religious freedom also. But the English laws on religion prevailed in several American colonies until the Revolution, when their discrimination and bias came under attack. In Virginia in particular, some patriots worked hard during and immediately after the Revolution to replace simple toleration with liberty, to make all religions equal under the law, and to disestablish the state church. And so this eventually came about, reacting still to existing laws that established religious tests and conferred special benefits on Anglicanism in some southern states and Congregationalism in some states in New England. Americans adopted the U.S. Constitution with amendments to protect certain rights against government action, something protect certain rights against government action, something in recent years we seem to still be contending with. But the first of these amendments contains the religious clauses that I previously quoted, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. The First Amendment also guarantees freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of assembly, all of which are essential to political and religious liberty. Thus, the principle, not law, of separation of church and state developed and was practiced as a specific remedy to former practices under which state-controlled church, church-controlled state, or church and state control worked in union to suppress those who didn't accept state-approved religion. The constitutional principles that recognize the whole idea of a healthy separation between church and state stands as a safeguard against both coercion in religion and also against government-sponsored religion. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that the Free Exercise Clause withholds from government any power to interfere with religious liberty or to coerce anyone to violate his or her religious conscience. The check and balance to be applied in free exercise cases is coercion. The Supreme Court ruled this, is if there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no government official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess by word or act their faith therein. You see, government has no power whatever to coerce people to engage in any religious exercise or to restrict such exercise on a personal basis. I think it is, I would say, quote, of course, because of religious fervor or because of political fervor, these concepts and laws are constantly being challenged. For instance, for more than three decades, there have been persistent attacks on the Supreme Court ruling in the so-called prayer and Bible reading case. Opponents consistently misrepresent the court's decisions, alleging that the court threw God and prayer and the Bible out of public schools. Well, the court overthrew only compulsory praying and compulsory Bible reading. It ruled that government cannot coerce anyone, especially children who attend public schools, to engage in required religious exercises. And of course, the court ruled correctly. Anyone who believes, as we do as Christians, that genuine faith is in response to divine grace. We agree that, don't we? Genuine faith is in response to divine grace. Anyone who believes that cannot accept the notion that government can force one to be a believer or that government-coerced religious exercises will produce faith. Now remember, I asked you to remember the Establishment Clause. In constitutional law, the Establishment Clause was designed to prevent three evils: government sponsorship of a religion, government's financial support of religion, and government's active involvement with religion. But the concept of separation in church and state does not in any way mean that you have to make your choice, one or the other. If I choose the church, I've got to abandon politics. Or if I choose to pursue political action or involvement, I have to put my church life aside? No, definitely it does not mean that. As a matter of fact, I believe dedication to God's demand is that you be involved in the lives and the pursuits of others of your society, which is kind of what politics is all about. So let us decide. It is compatible with the idea of separation in church and state for a person to be active both in state, in politics, and in church, in religion. No American law requires you to choose between church and state. On the contrary, the American legal principle is that you can participate both in the affairs of your church and of politics. You do not have to relinquish and give up civil rights in order to be a church leader. You do not have to forego religious activity in order to qualify for public office or public service. If you choose, or choose for your children, to forego public services, for example, if you choose for them not to go to public education, you do that voluntarily. The state is to take no action about that. Some improperly interpret separation of church and state to mean separation of religion and politics. Church is the institution of religion. The state is the institution of government. And they, as institutions, are to be separate, but can and do exist cooperatively, side by side. Christ told his disciples to submit to Caesar. Symbolically, that would be a government authority. To submit to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and to God what belongs to him. The reasonable inference from this commandment is that the Christian should discharge not one, but both civil and religious obligations. To render all to Caesar is to deprive God of what one rightly owes him. To withhold all from Caesar for the sake of the church is to deny what one rightly owes to the government. So what is the rightful function of a government? Well, government is essential to the total population of a society's well-being. God ordained civil authority for society's good and specifically for the restraint of evil, is what we read from Romans 13, the first three verses. It is proper to give due deference to government in areas where it has competence and responsibility. Thus, it is proper for all of us to pay our taxes to fund the work of government responsible for our well-being. That's verses 4 through 6. In the American system, each citizen, including the Christian, has the opportunity to take part in shaping government policy. Well, if I could escape being prejudicial, I would say especially the Christian. If early Christians were obligated, in keeping with the religious conscience, to honor the Roman government, how much more are present-day Christians obligated to take part in improving our current government? Now, I stand with my Lord Jesus Christ in believing that Christianity takes us beyond law's bounds that would set a limit on our generosity. Christians are to go further than government can lead them by a restrictive limit. Equitable law calls for one to grant to others the benefit he or she claims for self, and whereas Christian love cannot be satisfied with less than equity, we Christians should probably seek more abundance for others than for self. Paul expressed that God principle like this to the Galatian Christians. For the entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one command, love your neighbor as yourself. And to those he was writing from Rome, he said, love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Of all people, Christians should be exemplary citizens who lovingly go beyond the minimums in caring for our neighbors. In America, we have the freedom to do so, as we are not restricted politically by the state and not restricted in love by the church. If there is to be a free church in a free state, Christians must be active in supporting both church and state. The Christian has a twofold obligation: to render to the state what properly belongs to it, to render to God what properly belongs to him. If Christians continue to discharge this obligation, there will continue to be a free state in which justice prevails and in which free churches thrive, and there will be free churches that engage in genuine worship of God and instill high ethical ideals for humanity's betterment. I'm not going to talk anymore about politics. Next week's all going to be about religion. And that's all I'm going to say.